Hey everyone, it's Rich. One of the perks of hosting Privacy Files is all of the incredibly talented and heroic people that I get to meet. They all have fascinating stories to tell, and their lives are dedicated to keeping humanity safe. For me, it's really quite a privilege. And this episode is no exception. I spent some time diving into the adventurous and noble life of Ken Strange. Ken is a former FBI agent and author of the book, A Cop's Son, One G-Man's Fight Against Jihad, Global Fraud, and the Cartels. His adventures have taken him to more than 65 countries, and after spending time with Ken, something tells me that number won't stay static for long. We discuss a wide variety of topics, from organized crime and online romance scams, to open source intelligence and how Ken stays safe himself. We also pay homage to his father, whose 38-year career with the NYPD inspired Ken's journey in law enforcement. Toward the end, Ken talks about his life-transforming 500-mile, 31-day trek with his wife along the Camino de Santiago in Spain. My one takeaway from the interview: we need more people like Ken Strange. You're listening to Privacy Files. This episode is brought to you by Anonymy Labs, makers of MySudo, the world's only all-in-one privacy app, and Sudo Platform, the cloud-based platform companies turn to for seamlessly integrating identity protection solutions into their software. And have you heard about the MySudo web browser extension? Breaking your online data trail just got way easier. To learn more, visit mysudo.com. That's mysudo.com. Ken, welcome to Privacy Files.
Thank you, Rich. Happy to be on board.
Yeah, super excited to talk to you today. Great meeting you. You've lived quite an adventurous life. I guess that would be a little bit of an understatement.
Yes, I suppose there's a bit of the gypsy in me. That's what my mother told me.
So you've worked for the FBI, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and the Department of Justice. You also spent a few years as a private investigator, and you wrote a book recently here, A Cop's Son, One G-Man's Fight Against Jihad, Global Fraud, and the Cartels. So what got you started in this track of law enforcement?
The law enforcement thing actually was the result of being, you know, brought up by my father, who was a police officer with the NYPD, New York Police Department. And, you know, he had a 38-year career, gone from patrolman and rose through the ranks to deputy chief before he retired. So he started in 1953 and he retired in 1991. You know, and I looked up to him. He was a very good role model for me and for my family. And through that life, he introduced us to his colleagues. And, you know, you would spend time at barbecues or softball games with these people and really, really get to know them. And for me, I kind of looked at them as the good guys, you know, for the most part, right? I mean, there are bad cops, but for the most part, they were the good guys and they were good role models. And my father, again, was the kind of inspiration that had me think about a career.
And you sent a picture. Unfortunately, we're still audio only, but I think one of the pictures you have on your website, it shows you, is that after you graduated the academy and you're getting your FBI badge?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, with the credentials and my father, my parents were there on that day, my wife, my twin daughters. And dad is actually handing me, you know, it's a posed photo, but he's handing me my credentials. And I remember he said, good luck, G-Man. And that kind of stuck with me. But, you know, what's interesting, Rich, is also in attendance on that day, on that graduation day, was a Hollywood actress named Jodie Foster. And she was in the crowd. She was there, of course. She was prepping for her movie, Silence of the Lambs. And she was actually in our class. PT class, PE class, I should say, and another class also. And she actually went on some of our runs you know, we would do 5-10 mile runs, you know, once, twice a week. And she actually showed up, jumped on our bus, and I'm sitting next to her. She's kind of looking out the window. And I said, hey, you know, after this is all over and done, you know, would you like to have a beer with our group? And she kind of looked at me like, no, thanks. And so I kind of left her alone. And, you know, I know she was getting ready for this run and she was focusing on this run. And she did very well, as a matter of fact.
Wow, what a story. What are the odds?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I just when she said no thanks, I kind of left her alone with thoughts of Hannibal Lecter. So
to break it down then, so with the FBI, you were investigating lots of different crimes, of course, but a lot of focus on the jihad movement. With the USAID, it was global fraud. And then with the Department of Justice, it was a lot of cartel investigations. What can you clarify a little bit? What is the USAID? What do they do specifically?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. So it is not as well known as, you know, some of the other federal agencies. And the fact that it actually has a law enforcement component in it made it attractive to me because I was always interested in traveling. I enjoyed being overseas. And, you know, when I was with the FBI, I was approached by two ex-FBI agents who said, hey, look, you know, you should consider working with us. We are working for the Agency for International Development. It was started in 1961 during the Kennedy administration. And basically what USAID does is they administer aid all over the world. So you can imagine the money that's flowing out there to all over the world. And, you know, there are bad actors who will take advantage of those funds. So this was an elite fraud unit, and it, you know, they told me, look, you'll be on airplanes 5-6 days a week, and you'll be in Cairo, you'll be in Venezuela, you'll be all over the world, and that was the case. And I didn't know Rich, I didn't know fraud per se. This is something that I had to pick up and learn, but I relied on these two fellas and another person who were, you know, CPAs or, you know, forensic accountants, and they kind of tutored me in fraud. And so I was able to eventually hold my own.
It sounds like that particular role took you to a lot of different places around the world. Can you tell us a little bit about where that was?
Yeah, sure. So I, you know, first I started in Washington, D.C. I spent a few years there, but I was continuously on the road until we got an assignment in the first. Well, first it was an assignment to Nairobi, Kenya, but at the last minute, and my background was in Spanish, so I was a little disappointed. But at the last minute, one of the investigators in Costa Rica decided to go back to the IRS, to his old agency. And so that opened up a position for me as a Spanish speaker. They put me into Costa Rica, which was just a beautiful, beautiful assignment. But it had me running around all over Central America and South America. And it would take you to some far-flung places like the Mosquito Coast of Nicaragua, or down to the Amazon River in Peru, in Iquitos, and everywhere in between. So I got a really good feel for third world countries. But you also had to, and we were talking about this before your show, about protection. We were not authorized to carry weapons overseas, so we were a bit vulnerable. I mean, we did have diplomatic security agents at the embassy, and they carried, but when we did our investigations, we didn't have that authority. So we're kind of out there on our own. And there was some dicey situations out there. I mentioned it in my book, The Cop's Son. You know, there was one sociopathic former priest in Peru who just had a thing for me and, you know, was having people follow me and have his, you know, and then he was in cahoots with another fellow who was ex-military. So that was dangerous. They had me followed all over Lima, Peru, and other places. And then, you know, I'm working and living in El Salvador right after that civil war. And we had one ticklish situation where we were being followed by a car in rebel territory. So all of a sudden, someone hands one of the cops that's with me, puts a machine gun on my lap and says, I think you may need this. Okay.
Oh, wow. Right. Were you rethinking your life choices at that point?
Well, I don't know. You know, again, a bit of a gypsy, and there might be a little a gene in there with danger. You know.
So you mentioned the Mosquito Coast of Nicaragua. That's on the Atlantic side, right? So that's very remote.
Extremely remote. You're right, Rich. Yes.
And what was that? Did it have something to do with cartel, like drug trafficking or anything of that nature?
No, this was a misappropriation of U.S. government funds for Caribbean coast conservation. And so this was new. We were just starting up in Nicaragua. They had come out of an incredible civil war. And, you know, while I was on the Mosquito Coast, they would take me to the townspeople would show me trenches. And, you know, this is where the communists and this is where the Russians were and the Cubans. And when you arrive at the airport in Puerto Cabezas, you know, you'd actually see a burnt out armored truck. And that was just kind of reminding me that, you know, this is a tricky, dangerous place. You know, the Cubans, they were practicing, you know, the Bay of Pigs. They were practicing there in Nicaragua for their invasion of Cuba, which, as you know, didn't go very well. But, yeah, there were a number of projects. NGOs would be given monies. And I was there because there was a complaint of embezzlement. So my boss sent me out there. And, you know, it took two or three planes to get there and a crazy voyage by boat in a little boat, which we were almost swamped in a terrible storm.
It's amazing, though, when you give some of these countries a little bit of time. At the end of last year, 2023, I was in Bogota, Colombia for about 11 days. And, you know, nothing like the days of Pablo Escobar. It's just changed completely. A lot of people now living abroad over there, retiring there, very friendly people. Yes, there's still some of that, you know, narco trafficking going on. But, wow, what an improvement.
When we arrived in Costa Rica, again, there were a lot of Americans and Canadians there living there in retirement, but it was becoming a bit expensive. And so then at that time, the expats were beginning to look in other Central American countries. And Nicaragua was one of the countries that some of them would go to, you know.
Oh, really? And this is going back to what time period?
Right. So this would be 1994 to 96, right around then. But we had some expats that said, you know what, it's so much cheaper in Nicaragua than in Costa Rica. And the U.S. dollar goes a long, long way in Nicaragua.
Is that, I know a little bit off topic, but as you encounter these people on your travels, Americans, Canadians, whatever, is that really the primary motivator? Most cases you found that they were trying to find a more cost-efficient way of life?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, of course, you couldn't argue with the natural beauty of Costa Rica. I mean, it's a it's a tremendous place, gorgeous, gorgeous place. But yeah, some of them were very, you know, again, these are retirees, snowbirds that would go down there. And the dollar, at one time, the dollar was very good in Costa Rica. Then it got more and more expensive. And that's when some of the expat community decided to be, you know, they'd look in places like Honduras and even Nicaragua.
And so on all of your adventures traveling around the world, obviously you're encountering a variety of different cultures. But does crime in general pretty much look the same in terms of the motivating factors and how it's carried out and there's opportunity and so forth? I mean, did you see a common theme over the course of your career?
I'm operating in third world countries. So a lot of the folks, especially the lower middle class, the lower class, you know, they're kind of in desperate straits. So some of them are looking to turn to a life of crime or commit criminal acts. So, you know, you did see that. You learn to kind of stay away from certain places. You know, we had the diplomatic security agents they give us briefings, you know, what places to stay away from, what places, you know, we could engage with the people on the ground. But yes, there was always the element of, you know, you're a foreigner in a strange land. And so you have to know the territory and you have to be aware of the risks.
And when you were overseas, were you, I guess, operating as the person that you were representing the U.S. government, or were you, in a sense, kind of undercover?
I never did an undercover overseas. No, this was a straight up, you know, we had our credentials, we had a badge, and, you know, we were operating very overtly, transparently, basically interviewing both American citizens, employees of, for example, AID, contracting officers, and then the recipients, which in some cases were foreigners, and then you'd have to meet them, but always transparently. And sometimes we'd go to their place. Sometimes they would come to the embassy. It would depend on the situation in the country.
What was the process for getting A Cop's Son published? What did that look like, having to work with the FBI to get everything approved?
Yeah. I knew that in order to get the book out there, I would have to have them review it. That was part of the agreement that I signed when I first joined the FBI. You know, you sign a document saying that, again, if you decide to go forward with any type of a book, you know, they want to have a crack at it first. So it had to go to their what they call their pre-publication review unit, which is essentially lawyers, a bunch of lawyers that sift through the manuscript and decide what's going to remain in the book and what's going to be taken out, what's going to be redacted. So that became a very interesting and a lengthy process. I think they had my book for 16 months. And the kicker for me, because I was with not only the FBI, but two other federal agencies, and they were called stakeholders, that manuscript also had to go to them as well. So once the Bureau finished their work, they sent it to USAID, but AID had no comment about it. They said, fine. And then the Department of Justice had maybe two or three comments in it, you know, please take that out or don't mention that or change it. But mostly it was the FBI that, and I can understand that because at the time I was doing counterintelligence work, counterterrorism work, working with informants and, you know, sources. And they're trying to protect sources and our methods. So I understand that.
There are literally people in these agencies with the federal government whose job is primarily to do this, to review books?
Yes. I don't know enough about their background. I worked with, I had the relationship, I guess, with two or three of them, of the attorneys. And maybe it's one of those things where they kind of rotate and this is kind of part of their job. And then they do other things within, because I couldn't imagine them doing this day in and day out. It would be tough. But what was interesting is, for example, and you could negotiate. And I did that once or twice. There was one story that I thought should be in there. And they said, hell no, you're not going to get this past us. And I needed this story in there so badly because it dealt with the Castros, Fidel and Raul Castro, and my relationship with them. So, you know, they said, well, we're going to take this out. You can't do this. And the source, we have to protect the source. Yeah, but the source is dead. Well, that's no, you know, we still have to protect the source. So I went back to them and I said, look, could I change his profession? I mean, it won't be accurate, but it will still get me to Cuba. And they said, well, let's see what you can do. So I rewrote the person. I gave him a kind of a fictitious background. And they said, okay, yeah, all right. You did a good job protecting him. So you can get that chapter in. So it was, you know, you'd have to negotiate these things. It was crazy.
Any heartbreak on things that I'm sure were left out that you wish weren't?
Yes, there was one story that I thought was interesting. And when it came back, it was half of it was just obliterated. You know, you just see all these black marks all over the place. So I actually decided, Rich, to leave that in there because I thought it'll give the readers an idea of how sensitive my job was.
Smart.
In effect. I didn't figure this one would be would bother them, but apparently it did. And so I was stuck with that. And then we negotiated the other thing. And, you know, you have to give and take, I suppose.
Let's take a quick break for this message from our sponsor.
All ready to check out?
Yes, I loved the new summer collection.
It's so good, right? Before I ring you up, were you interested in joining our loyalty program for future discounts?
Oh yeah, that sounds awesome. How do I sign up?
Awesome, I can sign you up right now. I just need a few things from you.
Okay, that sounds great.
Okay, first thing I need is your
full name.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Sorry, I just need your
full name.
Oh, okay. It's Annapolis.
Perfect. Next thing I need is your...
phone number.
Excuse me?
Sorry about that. What's your...
phone number.
Do you really need that for my account?
I really need your...
email.
On second thought, I think I'm good on the rewards program. Thanks, though.
You never know what will happen with your personal information. Next time you want to get the discounts and rewards, use a MySudo phone number and email to receive the benefits without compromising your privacy. Download MySudo today and have peace of mind knowing your personal information is secure. To learn more, visit MySudo.com. That's MySudo.com. Stay private.
A little bit out of order, but I got to ask you this question. So you, obviously you mentioned that your dad spent 38 years in the NYPD, and you grew up in Brooklyn, I guess, in kind of the, I guess you're coming of age in the 60s, I would imagine, kind of in that time frame. What was Brooklyn like back then? And have you been back since? And what changes have you seen?
It was the early 60s, I guess. That's what kind of a coming of age for me. You know, this was a lower class, lower middle class or middle class neighborhood. You know, I lived in one of these brick row houses. But I had plenty of friends, and it was, you know, you could just pop out of your house and you'd have 15, 20 other people in the street. And, you know, you're playing in the schoolyard, you're playing stickball, boxball, handball, you know, so you didn't want for friends. And it was a different world back then because crime wasn't rampant per se, and you could leave your doors unlocked. And it was a totally, totally different world. Yes, I've been back for different reunions. I had a 45th. Elementary school reunion. I went back there. The neighborhood has actually changed. Back then it was working class. And now in this, it's the Marine Park, Kings Plaza area of Brooklyn. Now it's kind of, you know, for yuppies and, you know, these dinks that are there. And, you know, the housing prices have gone up and it's no longer a working class neighborhood, but it's actually a coveted place to live.
You mentioned to me that this was the time when you really got interested in writing. You said you spent a lot of time at a library. I think it was the Brooklyn Public Library.
So about a mile away from my house was the branch of the Brooklyn Public Library. And so for me, that place was a refuge to kind of escape this urban monotony. And I would go in there and I would just voraciously take on books of all kinds, but mostly science fiction. I was much taken with Ray Bradbury, for example, but there were also adventure books and Jack London, and I would read the classics and just about anything I could get my hands on. And so right after that, I guess I was about 10 or 11, I started writing science fiction stories. And oddly enough, I would take them to my father, you know, like say on a Saturday morning after breakfast, and say, "Dad, look what I did. Look at this." And he would coach me, and he was very well read, and he knew other books I should read. And he would say, "Well, you should try this book and that book. Have you read this and that?" So he was very supportive. And so I just continued to write. And that kind of took me all the way, writing for newspapers, high school, college, small town, overseas. So I would continue writing. And kind of a funny story about Ray Bradbury. Here was a guy that I think I read just about everything he wrote. And so about a year before I retired from the federal government out in California, we were based on Brand Boulevard in Glendale. And so I remember just before I retired, I took a walk during lunch and I had a favorite indie bookstore called The Imaginarium. Science fiction. And so I peek in there, as was my habit. And there on the bulletin board was an announcement. And it said, "Birthday party for Ray Bradbury, 88th birthday, please come." Yeah, so I'm like, oh, with my luck, it happened last week or yesterday, right? But I was fortunate. It was like a week out. So I couldn't sleep for that whole week. And I'm like, I couldn't wait to get there. I think I got to the bookstore 2 hours early. I grabbed the Martian Chronicles off the shelf, and this is the book he's going to sign. But it was also packed. I mean, it was packed. This little place was just, and it was Hollywood too, because when he came in, he was rolled in by Bo Derek, the actress. You know, he's in a wheelchair, and so he's in there. They have a cake for him. The place is buzzing. I hopped on a line to get the book signed. as I made my way around there, it was annoying. It was very noisy. And I thought, wait, he's down there in this wheelchair. I'm 6'3". So it's going to be hard to kind of scream at him. Hey, mister, you know, this is what I think of you. Please sign my book. So when I got to him, I went into this catcher's crouch and I start rocking on the, you know, on my feet. I'm like, oh my God, don't fall. And I said to him, I just let it go. It was heart to heart. And I said, Mr. Bradbury, love you. You know, you changed my life. I was in Brooklyn. You took me to other places all over the world and other planets. And, you know, if it weren't for you, I wouldn't, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I noticed when I'm saying this, he begins to tear up and he grabs me and pulls me into him and he kisses me on the cheek. And I like, whoa, my God, what has just happened? I just got kissed by my idol. And now I tell the story to friends and they say, oh, that's nothing. You know, Ray Bradbury. Now, if it was Bo Derek that kissed you, that would be different.
Wow, what a story. To talk a little bit more about the global fraud situation, there was an article recently, Time Magazine published it. It was entitled The Golden Age of Scams. And I think especially with the rise of artificial intelligence, it's a lot more difficult to spot these scams that are oftentimes based overseas. One of the big ones these days, I'm sure you're familiar with, is this pig butchering scam where, you know, they start off basically as this budding romance and you never really meet the person, but they convince you to go to some website and invest in some cryptocurrency. The whole website's a scam. All the money's going to them. Yes. It's not going to a real, you know, official business, but the scams, the fraud in general has become so sophisticated. Most of it now is obviously operated by organized crime. Can you speak to kind of the evolution of what organized crime has become from when you started your career? Is there, I'm just interested if you have a perspective on that.
Yeah, certainly. This type of crime has been with us since civilization began. It just becomes more sophisticated and it reflects the progress of the culture and the tools that the culture has. So, you know, you see we progress and we inherit these new things and computers, and right behind us are these people that will say, okay, now we have a computer. How can we use this to make money and scam people? So that's, you know, they're right behind us and sometimes they get out in front of us. As far as scamming, and I'm thinking of catfishing, for example, I remember there was, before I retired, we had one case where a gentleman came in and he was vulnerable. He was in his late 60s. Geez, kind of like me, right? And he, you know, he was saying how he had been taken by some beautiful lady. He had a relationship with her on the internet. This went on for like 2 or 3 years. And he had sent her like, I don't know, about $20,000. It was always some excuse that she needed. I needed this for my relatives or for my this, or I need to buy a car and I love you. And he shows me the picture of the woman and it's like, you know, a Hollywood actress, you know, just drop dead gorgeous. And I'm thinking, dude, look at you and look at her. I mean, this doesn't match. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he just, you know, he was in such denial. And he said, no, Mr. Strange, you have it wrong. You know, she really does love me. I'm special to her. And I'm like, yeah, I'm sure you are. But, you know, we sat down with him and we actually turned this complaint over to the FBI. But I gave him some advice. I said, you know, you should cut this relationship off now. You've lost $20,000. You've never met her. She's always giving you excuses when you want to travel to her, blah, blah, blah. And he was nodding. And then as he left, he turned to me and he said, but Mr. Strange, I still love her. Well, her is maybe three Nigerian guys operating in Nairobi. I forget the capital of Nigeria, but yeah. So, you know, these are the type of scams. Some of them are fatal. I remember one case, and this is very popular. I saw it on television, where a American musician out of San Francisco fell in love with a Brazilian woman, and she was playing him like a fiddle. And, you know, he finally went down there, made two trips down there, and then he noticed that it was getting, she had more and more demands. I need a car. And so then he would pay for the car. And then he noticed every time he went there, he was missing credit cards, and then he would notice, he'd go to his bank account, and it was drained. So finally, and here was the crazy part. Finally, he says, I'm going to show her. I'm going to go down there and I'm going to stop it. And I'm going to break up with her there. They killed him.
Wow.
She killed him with her lover on his birthday. And they burned his body. And it's one of those stories that's just, please, you know, stay away from stuff like that. You know, you're so desperate for a relationship that you're losing all your money and you end up paying for it with your life. So, and they've never convicted, you know, they, I think they prosecuted her and they're not able to get a conviction yet. It's the saddest story I have ever heard of.
They really play on the psychology.
Yes. Yes, they do. The weakness, the vulnerabilities, you got it right. You said you nailed it. The psychology.
Yeah. So I'm trying to really think about the overall broader picture of your career. As you talk about working at the FBI, the USAID, the Department of Justice, you know, in at every stage, you're dealing with really sophisticated levels of organized crime. And I wonder, you know, what about, you know, your own safety? You know, obviously the show is Privacy Files, and we talk a lot about individual privacy and data protection and being, again, careful about what your digital footprint is out there, because it's so easy with, you know, open source intelligence. It's very easy to look up a lot of people because they live their lives on social media. And I'm curious, like, at what point in your career did that start becoming a reality for you as you think about, boy, I got to protect myself, I got to protect my family?
So I didn't really worry much about it while I was working for these agencies. I always felt relatively protected, and, you know, they kept your driver's license and your personal identification kind of out of the way. They protected it. But once you retire, you know, it's kind of all bets are off, and you're on your own out there in the jungle. So I think it's a lot of it, Rich, is common sense, kind of be aware of your surroundings. But more recently, and this kind of worries me a little bit because I'm out there on LinkedIn and other social media, I'm promoting a book, and I've noticed that there are people that try to connect with me. I realize that they're not who they say they are. I'm always wary of these, and especially in LinkedIn, you see some of these probably some of the most beautiful women on the planet. Many of them are from Asia, and you just say, oh my God, you know, now I know how that other guy felt complained to me. So right away, when I see that, I immediately, you know, move on or block or, and that also happens on X as well. So you've got, and inevitably, you know, sometimes you see someone, oh yeah, I think I'd like to connect with that person. And then you realize, they're trying to scam you. You know, oh, where do you live? And didn't you read my profile? So that's kind of a clue to me. Or one I got was this was a Gaddafi's daughter. I'm Gaddafi's daughter, and I know where the money is, but I need you to give me some of your bank information. And on that, well, the two of us will run away, and all this money is yours. I mean, come on. So, you know, these are things that you can't be taken in with. You have to be careful. Phishing, you know, all of that stuff. You have to be careful of that that as well. So I would just say be aware of your surroundings. When I get out into the street, I look around, except for when I walk, because you know what happened to my knee. But but overall, you know, I'm always looking for the exit. I guess that's the way. I go to church. Where's the exit? You know, with people, with guns and things. What am I going to do? I always, in my mind, I'm playing out scenarios. You know, if this happens, what will I do? And where's the exit? That type of thing.
I guess a lot of it's, of course, is usually common sense, which, of course, is not always very common. But as somebody who's had a long professional, you know, law enforcement career, you're basically a trained observer. So you're very aware, you know, you have great situational awareness, I guess.
Yeah, I mean that's ideal for our work as well. For me, I always I guess my strength was in the personal relationships, the kind of the social scientist. I've always enjoyed that part of the work, the investigations, the interviews. You know, you have to be part psychologist. You have to be a great listener. I always thought the better you can listen, the more progress you'll make in an investigation or in a relationship, say with say a confidential informant. So you also have to have kind of like an anthropological insight into people, because, you know, I met so many people from all walks of life, from all cultures. And but, you know, a lot of us, a lot of these people have a lot in common, too, you know, family, love of family. And so, you know, the world is not as disparate as you would believe.
Let's take a quick break for this message from our sponsor.
Most people don't realize the weakest link in your digital privacy is your inbox. Deep down in the dark corners of the web, there are live auctions occurring.
Hey, over here, we got a phone number for sale, right here, and over here, home address. Hey, wait, don't leave, come back.
I have the best list of usernames and passwords available. You want it? Come talk to me, I'll give you a fair
pass. I have credit cards over here with the security number. They've all been tested. No, I'm being
serious. I got a full name and birthday combo right here, people. Who wants it? That's full name, birthday combo.
Yes, your personal information is being auctioned off, often without your knowledge. Every time a company experiences a data breach, your information could be up for grabs to the highest bidder.
Sold.
With Reclaim, you take your first step towards taking back control of your digital privacy. Reclaim works in three steps: scan, discover, remove. Imagine a world where you're in charge of your own privacy, where your information can be taken back. That's the world Reclaim helps create. To learn more, go to anonymy.com/reclaim and start your journey towards better privacy today.
And also, too, I mean, your travels took you to Spain at one point, and I noticed you've written a book, It's Your Camino, which kind of chronicles, I guess, you and your wife walk the Camino de Santiago in Spain, which is, I guess it's about 500 miles, I think, right?
Yes, that's right. Absolutely. 500 miles. We, my wife and I decided, you know, at age, I think I was 62, and I want to get off this corporate treadmill. And so it was just the right time. My wife and I were doing some volunteer work in Malibu, and we met Martin Sheen, the West Wing actor, and also the he had a movie about the Camino called The Way with his son Emilio Estevez. So we met him in Mexico and doing this work, and he just talked our ears off all day about how you and your wife need to do the Camino. And so, you know, that was kind of the last straw for us. That really pushed us to do the Camino. And, you know, we went to France, and then you start in France and you finish up in Santiago de Compostela in Spain. It took us 31 days. It was 500 miles. And it was a life-changing experience for both of us. When I got back, I started writing for about 4 or 5 months. And then I came up with a manuscript, and I worked on it for about 4 to 5 months. And then all of a sudden I knew I had this manuscript and I had these photos. And that's when I went back to Martin Sheen with the manuscript. And I said, Martin, look, you got us into this. Could you take a look at the manuscript? And he surprised us and said, yes, I'd love to. And a few days later, I got this phone call and it read unknown. So I didn't know who was calling me. But when I heard that West Wing actor voice, Ken, it's Martin Sheen. I was like, oh, my God. And he said, I love your book. And we really did. And what can I do for you? And I said, well, you know, a cover quote would be wonderful. And he said, I'll do it. And wow. Again, you know, I know he's busy. So, and then about a week later, in the mail, he had a letter with, you know, 5 cover quotes. And he said, take any one of these quotes or a combination thereof. And that, what a nice man.
What a thrill. Yeah, gosh, that's amazing. And so what did you, obviously you met a lot of people along the way. I'm always fascinated by these kind of breaks, if you will, taking a pause from career and kind of reevaluating life, if you will. Did you, as you're talking to people along that trail, and you said you are fluent in Spanish, did you find, you know, a variety of motivations for taking that trek, which you said is about 30 or so days?
Yeah, it took us 31 days. Yes, I mean, and that was the beauty of the whole trip was the, for me, it was the other pilgrims. And the stories you would hear, there were people out there that were doing the Camino for a variety of reasons, all kinds of reasons. There were some people that were there to escape something. Other people were looking for something that they had and now had lost. Other people were there to reflect on their lives. Met an older couple trying to figure out, what are we going to do in the next 20 years before we die? What's our goal? So, 500 miles gives you plenty of time to reflect on, you know, the past, where you are today, and what you want to be doing in the future. But, some of the stories, we met a blind couple walking the Camino. They were from the United States. They had an app for the blind. He was a lawyer. She was a teacher. And I think probably the most moving point was we were walking with them, and we got to a small stream with a Roman bridge. And the fella said, "Ken, can you tell me what you see?" I almost lost it. It suddenly dawned on me that I had taken my sight for granted. And here was somebody asking me to describe the scene. It was really, really hit me like a ton of bricks. And I described the scene as best I could, you know. So people like that. And there was also a woman who had just lost her only son in a car crash. And she was from Florida. She said, "I sold my everything. I got out of my apartment. I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. I just lost my son." So, it was very, very interesting. A lot of it was very moving.
Wow. And then I kind of glossed over it very quickly, but you did spend, I guess, 5 or 6 years as a private investigator before you hung it up for good.
Yes.
And what kind of cases did you work on in that capacity?
It was fascinating because you no longer have that support from the government. You cannot get subpoenas and things like that. So, and you're pretty much on your own. You're not armed for the most part. I certainly wasn't. Just a variety of cases. Much of it is just background information and anything from, "Hey, my daughter's getting married to this guy. Can we trust the guy? Can you, can you go in and find out stuff on him if there is stuff?" That was very basic. And so I did a little bit of that. So there were a lot of different cases, but some of them stand out. One was a missing persons case. And this was an older son who, had some mental issues and, was a very bright person, went to some wonderful schools, had a nice job, and then everything imploded on the fella. And he ended up coming back and living with his parents. And his father was always, riding him, pushing him. "Well, you had so much potential. Look at you now." That didn't help him. And then he ran away. So this was kind of like a 35-year-old, 40-year-old adult son. And they were asking me, "Could you find our son? We're worried about him." It took me about a week, and I was down to my last witness. And I called, and she was up in the Bay Area. And I called her, and I said, "Hey, I'm this and I'm that." And she said, "It's funny you're calling me because he just reached out to me. He's up here in the Bay Area. In fact, he is going to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge."
Oh no.
Yeah. So, I went, started calling the Golden Gate. I didn't even realize that they have a police department for the bridge. So they got him off the bridge. He ended up staying with her for about a week. And then finally the parents went up there and took him back, took him home. So, the mother said to me, "Ken, what do I do now?" And I said, "Ma'am, I've done my job. I found your son. It's up to you now to work with him and maybe find him a psychiatrist or something." I mean, it's about mental health.
Sure.
And then sadly, just a few months later, he went back to the Golden Gate Bridge, and this time he jumped. So I always felt bad about that case. But she called me up and said, "Don't feel so bad because you gave me 3 more months with my son." And that was, I guess I did, but that was a fascinating case. And then the other one was a, this was a client that came to us. He had been arrested by the police for a Bitcoin deal that went south. And the cast of characters that were involved in this deal, I mean, it was like, you know, someone from the Crips and the Bloods, a cartel guy from the Mexican. There was an Armenian mafia. There was a bogus attorney from Long Beach. And a guy with a huge gun that came in and took all their money, $250,000. And so when the police show up, they arrest the black guy, our client. And so, you know, I ended up, I did my due diligence. And look, the police don't have the time to do all this work. They have a lot of other cases going. But I had time. And the person that solved the case was actually the little old lady in Pasadena. She was kind of a grocer, and she had this camera, CCTV camera. And I just happened to see this store. I almost didn't stop. And, you know, I said, what is this? And I see a little camera. Go in, the lady. And then she says, and she barely talked English. She was Armenian. And she said, oh, come. And we get to this room, and it's like something the FBI would be jealous of. You know, it has camera, you know, TVs all over this room, and you know, operators watching it. So I said, could you pull this from this date, from this time? And sure enough, she had it. She found the guy with the hood, with the bag of money, going to the car, and there's the car with the license plate. I said, please, you freeze this. I need this, you know. And so that exonerated our client. I turned it over to the police, and they immediately exonerated my client. And so that was the bad guy. But this little old Armenian woman was the person that really solved the case.
Incredible. And you touched on it again a little bit. I think from time to time on the show, we talk about it, and I think people are so surprised they when it comes to OSINT or open source intelligence, just how much information is available on the average person for free? Like, I mean, I know as a private investigator, you had access to other tools too, but just free sources alone, you can get you can gather a lot on people.
Absolutely. It's amazing what's out there. You know, you can just go on the internet, just plug in the person's name. And if you have patience, you know, you can spend half an hour just kind of going from, and look, if there's any derogatory information, usually will pop up. You know, you'll see a maybe some kind of a legal case, a civil case that the person's been involved with, or a criminal case, or other things. He's in a story or an article for not the reasons you want to be in an article for. So yes, I've always made use of that, the open source stuff. You can find a lot of nuggets of information. I would recommend that to people that have any questions about suspect people in their lives.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have a lot of digital exhaust to clean up too.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm one of them for sure. I'm still in it's a work in progress.
Oh, come on.
So, and before we go, is there anything else you wanted to touch on? I mean, it's such a fascinating career, and I know we could probably do this for hours. I really find this all incredibly fascinating.
I would just say, as far as this new book that I have out, and it's an award-winning true crime memoir. You know, I would say this, and a reviewer put something in it in LinkedIn the other day, and he said, if you're looking for just another cop book, this isn't it. And he's right. And I think it's because of the diversity of investigations that you will find in my book, because you're dealing with, you know, three distinct and distinguished federal agencies, three different disciplines as well, both in cases in the United States and all over the world. So it's a unique book. It's an unusual book, but it's unique.
And where can they? So It's Your Camino and A Cop's Son. Where can people find that?
Right. So It's Your Camino would be on Amazon, and Cop's Son is on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And I have another book coming out in 2025 called Land of Sand. It's a coming of age love story based in the Middle East.
And just to be sure, you're sure you're fully retired, so you're not taking any more cases.
I swear. I'm out. And don't drag me back in there, Rich.
Well, Ken Strange, thank you so much for your time. This is fascinating. I really enjoyed it.
Same here, Rich. Pleasure talking to you.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Privacy Files. If you would like to be on the show or you know someone who would be a good fit, head on over to privacyfiles.com and submit a guest request. Also, if you're enjoying the content we're cranking out, please consider giving us a 5-star rating in your favorite podcast player. It might seem like a small thing, but it does help others find us. These are people just like you, people who are on their own privacy journey. In our next episode, we created a panel here in studio to discuss the significance of France's arrest of Telegram CEO Pavel Durov. Was this an affront to privacy, or just a matter of one person thinking he's above the law? We'll be discussing this and a whole lot more. Until next time, don't forget, privacy is a human right.